even if he was wearing armour. Important Phoenicians lined up to receive a slab of the snake meat, which was cut by a tall Terran slave with a carving knife. Jai watched the scene for a moment, noticing how none of the wealthy attendees so much as looked at the slave. In less time than it took him to carve each cut of meat, he could stab the knife through one of their hearts, but they didn't fear him. No, in their eyes, he was broken, of no concern. Jai gritted his teeth and moved on. Though he kept his head down as he limped through the regaled royalty, he occasionally flicked his eyes up to seek Shanti's face. After all, he had seen her in the Emperor's corridor, which might mean she would be assigned to his royal events. His frustration mounted with each trip from the feast room with another stack of dirty dishes for the kitchen. Not only had he not seen Shanti, but the Emperor had yet to make an appearance. He'd been in Fenir for more than a week, and hadn't so much as caught a glimpse of Falcon. How could he kill a man he couldn't find? When he returned to the hall, however, something had changed. There was a buzz in the air which he noticed immediately. People were still chattering, but their voices had dropped lower, and all eyes were focused on the front of the room, where two familiar young men sat in large, high-backed chairs, their hands resting casually on armrests. They generally ignored the hubbub, speaking only to each other, waiting to be served. That's when he saw her for the second time, her strong, capable form moving nimbly through the room, balancing large plates on the palm of each hand. Shanti handed a plate to each of the younger Hosa brothers, and they didn't even acknowledge her. She was the most beautiful woman Jai had ever seen, and she might as well have been a ghost. With a start, Jai realized he was still staring at her, watching as she spun on her heel, retreating to the food lines. Her eyes found his, and though she once again pretended not to notice him, her eyes gliding past like gusts of wind, this time she winked. His heart swelled, and it was all he could do to keep his feet moving, to gather the next stack of dirty plates. When he returned, he spotted her right away, because she was standing at the focal point of the entire room, handing a plate to one final newcomer. Emperor Falcon, Jai thought, taking in his enemy in a glance. He and his two brothers were three of a kind, with their powdered faces, jeweled scalps and brows, and upright, stern positioning. The Emperor's lips moved, but Jai was fairly certain he hadn't spoken, for his brothers didn't notice. "Thank you," he mouthed, the words directed at Shanti. When she turned away, there was no mistaking the shallow smile on her lips. Jai felt gut-punched. Everything about their interaction went against the standard slave-master system in place. Everything about it was far too casual, familiar. The truth slapped him in the face, and he almost dropped a dish. She's gotten herself close enough to the Emperor to kill him. Her eyes found his, and this time there was no mistaking the words she mouthed to him. "Be careful." And then she was gone. She didn't return to the gala that night. 75. The Southern Empire, Fanes. Falcon Hosa. He'd sent for Shanti 3 nights in a row, asking for her to deliver a sleeping draught to help him rest. And all 3 nights, he'd dumped the draught in his chamber pot. Sleep was the last thing he was interested in. The Terran woman had been all too willing to share her story, dumping it out like a box of broken ceramic figurines, her eyes stabbing daggers of accusation at Falcon the whole time. How her family had been enslaved in Terragon's capital city when she was just a child. How she'd been dragged from her home, abused, chained to a ship. How her father had been murdered, protecting her sister. How her sister had been murdered anyway, her mother taken away from her. How she had escaped, somehow developing immunity to the slave master's powers. The story was as tragic as the fiction he usually read, and it tugged at his heartstrings all the more because of who was telling it. Though her voice never wavered, her eyes as dry as the Skara Desert, the pain she still felt was in every word, punctuated by the black tears etched on her cheeks. When she finally finished her tale, Falcon felt as if nails had been driven into his chest. He always knew his father was a monster, but he'd avoided hearing about what he did as much as possible. Something else nagged at him. The part about her mother, who was taken away. He also remembered how something about Shanti had been familiar to him, despite the strange tears on her cheeks. A memory was unchained, breaking free in his mind. He winced visibly. His eyes closed. "Do my words sorrow you?" Shanti said, cocking her head to the side mockingly. She was fearless, and he wondered if it was because she knew he was weak, or if she simply no longer cared what happened to her. "Yes," he said, his voice raspy. "It is one of a million, and there are worse than mine. Nails driven on top of nails."
"I'm sorry."
Even as he said it, Falcon knew it was the weakest response of a plethora of weak responses that had sprung to mind. "Sorry." Shanti's lips had pulled into a tight line, and Falcon had the impression she was fighting back the urge to destroy him, chains or not. In many ways, he wished she would, especially now that he knew he'd seen her mother before, that he knew what had happened to her. A stronger man would tell her, but he was no such man. Never would be. He shook his head.
"Yes, but more than that. I am ashamed."
"Save it for someone who believes you." She wheeled around, turning to leave in the same manner she had the previous two nights, like a whirlwind of fury.
"Why did you say I am going to die?" he asked.
He'd wanted to ask since the moment she said it, but had been nervous, though he wasn't sure why. She turned back for a moment, her eyes narrowing.
"Haven't you finished that book I gave you yet?"
He shook his head. Each night when she left, he was so exhausted he'd fallen right to sleep, his dreams full of images from her ongoing story.
"Read it," she said, and then she was gone.
Falkenhoser read all night, turning the pages with a vigor more driven by anxiety than a desire to finish the book. The story was a good one, about a misunderstood group of people with mottled flesh and long, clawed fingers, who were treated like nothing more than animals by the nation that had conquered them. But he didn't enjoy it the way he normally would. For one, the parallels to the realities of the Phoenicians, of his father, his brothers, himself, were so numerous and obvious it was almost a fictional work of treason. Secondly, the last page was fast approaching, and he'd realized something. Shanti had claimed to have only read the last page of the book. The urge to skip pages, to skim, to go straight to the final piece of parchment was powerful, but he continued reading, forcing himself not to miss a single word. She'd shared her story with him. He owed her that much at least. The area around his window shades was lightening, and his eyes were stinging when he did, finally, reach the last page. He'd read through the night, he realized. Now that he was here, he didn't want to find out the ending, because there was no good outcome in sight. The enslaved people were broken, beaten down, each new generation less hopeful than the one before it, until the word hope didn't even exist in their language. The ruler of the dominant people had died, but he had three sons to continue ruling, to maintain their way of life. None had shown any signs of wanting to change. The last line on the second-to-last page felt like a black hole sucking him into it. Those defeated dream of escape. Their rulers die alone and heavy. The hourglass empties, the final grain of sand falling to the pile. Change? Change does not exist in their world. He took a deep breath, the edge of the page scraping loudly against the parchment as he turned it, grating his ears. Numbly, he stared at the final page in the saddest story he'd ever read. It contained only one word. Unless. The ending had been so different to what Falcon had expected, what Shanti had insinuated, that the Emperor couldn't stop thinking about it. Though another war council was scheduled for that very day, Falcon cancelled it, making up an excuse about being unwell and needing a day to rest. Most of the day, he lay on the floor, ignoring knocks on his locked door, his brother's voices demanding him to let them in.
Instead, he read the words again and again, trying to understand how the open-ended conclusion to the book was linked to his own death. By the time the sun had set and his stomach was empty and clawing at him from the inside, his mouth dry from lack of water, he was about ready to tear out the page and fling the book across the room. It clicked.
"She wasn't threatening me," he said aloud,
the idea taking shape, dawning bright and gold. He shook his head, wondering how he'd been so foolish. His own fear of death had painted the worst possible outcome in his mind, but all she'd been telling him was what he already knew, what every man already knew, that they would, one day, die. But between birth and death, there was a whole lot of time that needed to be filled. Most referred to that time as life, but to Falcon it had always felt like an infinite black space, a countdown. Like the book said, the grains of sand flowing through an hourglass until none were left at the top. The truth was, Falcon had never loved his life, despite the riches and status that came with it.
"No, it's more than that," he thought,
his fingers tracing the letters printed in the book.
"I loathe my life. Always have."
The word hate rose to his mind so easily, too easily. But that single word and the three dots of possibility that followed it, unless, seemed to emulate everything that was Shanti. She'd lived her life with purpose, fighting for a cause she believed in, a cause that seemed as hopeless as the plight of the broken people in the book. She was no emperor, had no armies, had no wealth to back her efforts. None of the Black Tears did, as far as he knew. And yet, the small measure of success they'd had, enough to make his father, the slave master himself, curse their names, was the very embodiment of hope. And her message to him was clear. You can do something. The only problem was that he couldn't. Not really. But he could tell her the truth about her mother. Maybe then she would see reason. Maybe then she would give up.
76. The Southern Empire, Calypso. Raven Sands.
"I want to come with you," Whisper said. "Please."
Raven didn't look at her. Couldn't look at her. Instead, she stayed busy, hastily packing supplies for the short trip she'd be making on Dragonback. "No," she said.
"Sister."
Whisper grabbed her arm.
"Sister."
Finally, Raven met Whisper's eyes and was ashamed at what she saw there. Love. Need. Fear.
"Whisper, I can't do this right now. I have to know. I have to be certain. You asked me to speak my mind. This is me speaking my mind. I'm coming with you."
Not a request. Not anymore. If Raven didn't feel so ill, she would have been proud of her sister. Whisper was growing in strength by the day, casting away her childhood like all Sands women did eventually. "Yes, she will make a fine ruler once I am gone. Probably a better one than either Fire or I ever did." "Thank you for speaking out in the War Council," Raven said. "You have done all I asked for and more. But sending the last two daughters to the Borderlands is too risky. I will not allow it. You must stay here as tradition requires." Whisper's nose scrunched and her lips knotted together angrily. She shook her head, tears already beading along the bottom half of her eyelids.
"Because you might die. Because you might leave me. Just like everyone else."
Raven wanted to hug her, to hold her, to tell her she wasn't going to die, to tell her she would never be alone, not ever again. But those were lies, and Raven couldn't treat her like a child anymore. She turned away. "Yes," she said. "I might die." She turned back. Whisper dashed the unshed tears away with a knuckle. Raven said,
"Any of us might die on any day. That is just life. But this is only a scouting mission. We will not engage the enemy unless absolutely necessary. They cannot hurt us in the sky."
"Fine," Whisper said. Her fierceness was back.
"I will pray for you on Calypa."
"Thank you, sister." Raven strode away, afraid her resolve would shatter if she looked back. As Raven prepared to depart Calypso, she received another stream from Zune, from her Aunt Viper. This was not a profit report. This was a personal message, informing the Empress that the second daughter would be visiting the city of the Rising Sun within the fortnight. Raven felt like crumping the note. She didn't, breathing away her frustration. Of all the times for Viper to want to visit Calypso, this was the worst. She froze, scanning the note once more with narrowed eyes. Something about the timing. What with the disaster in the Skara, the testing of the Dragonia, Rhone Loren's sudden appearance. Raven's mother had never believed in coincidence, and neither did she. Her aunt was a shrewd woman with a long memory. Quickly, she penned a message using an ink reed harvested from the central stream in Zune. Dear Aunt Viper. When she was finished, she found a messenger and sent him scurrying back to the royal stream with the message, which politely requested that her aunt remain in Zune to oversee the fighting pits, and that the Empress would visit Zune soon. I am the Empress, she thought. The sooner Viper remembers that, the better. Despite the maddening circumstances, Raven felt alive, soaring above the clouds. Ceres' leathery wings beat the hot air, creating her own wind. The dragon's spiked, scaly skin was alive beneath the saddle, cresting and crashing like oceanic waves. A sea in the sky, Raven thought, using her hand to shield her eyes from the sun. Ryder was on one side, astride Heyron, Shanalyn on the other, riding Cronus. Though the Dragonmasters had offered the entire strength of the Dragonia for the mission, Raven had declined. They needed speed and stealth, not strength. The plan was to make the 3-day flight to the easternmost edge of the Skara in 2 days, perform aerial reconnaissance to determine the situation at present, and then make for Kesh, the desert village from which they'd received the stream. At first, Cronus had snapped at Ciri, jealous of her position in the center of the formation. But after the tenacious female responded with a slap of her spiked tail in his face, the sleek, grey dragon had grudgingly settled into formation. Heyron, on the other hand, hadn't put up a fuss, assuming the left flank without so much as batting an eye. Despite his size and strength, the dark-scaled monster was an even-tempered creature. This was day 2 of their journey, and beneath them the clouds looked as fluffy as giant pillows. Between them, Raven spotted splashes of brown and white, the alternating sands of the Skara. And to the east, the blue, diamond-speckled waters of Dragon Bay. Far to the north, the ground turned grey and then bright green, rolling out like a massive rug. Ironclad territory. "How far?" Raven shouted over the beating of wings. She was growing more and more anxious as they closed the distance to the borderlands. Ryder and Shanalyn looked past Raven to meet each other's eyes. "Half a day," they said at the same time. Though they disagreed on much, when it came to details about dragons, their speed, their abilities, their temperaments, the two masters found common ground. Damn, Raven thought. She was hoping to make it before nightfall, when visibility would still be at its best. Instead, the sun would be long gone, leaving them to scout by moons and starlight. She ducked her head lower and shouted into the wind.
Yah!
Ciri shot forward, instinctively searching for the air currents that would further increase her speed. The two larger dragons gave chase, though they swiftly fell behind. Raven could hear her dragonmaster's cries drifting away behind her, lost on the wind. Hours later, after the sun had sunk below the horizon, after the purple sky had given way to navy and then an ink-black plain speckled with stars, Raven and Ciri descended toward the desert. Under the light of Ruahi and Luahi, the two moons casting dueling bands of light across the sand, Raven saw them. Dark slashes, some straight as arrows, others curled like question marks. 2 dozen, perhaps. No, 3 dozen, Raven remembered. After all, it was she who had given the order to 36 of her Guanero. 36 souls who had now left their bodies to seek the halls of the gods. The pit she'd had in her stomach for the last 2 days grew into a fist, punching the inside of her abdomen. Ciri swooped lower, and Raven forced herself to look. She owed them that much. Most of the bodies were half-covered by the ever-shifting dunes, the desert trying to claim them before the birds could turn them into carrion. There a leg stuck out, here an arm. She saw a few bits of leather armour bearing the Calypsian sigil. Several familiar faces, staring blankly toward the night sky. The ill feeling continued, but she swallowed it down. She wouldn't lose her stomach. She would mourn these loyal, capable men and women with her every thought, and then she would clear her head and decide what to do next. They deserved better. They deserved to live. She brought Ciri into a hover over the carnage. Her voice barely above a whisper, Raven spoke each of their names, for she knew every member of her Guanero by name and face. Scarab, Jorg, Valia. About halfway through the list, Shanalin and Ryder arrived, settling their own dragons into a hover. They didn't speak, listening to Raven's accounting of the dead in silence. Bryn, Hez, Nura. And on, until Raven reached the end of the list, a final name. Goggins, second in command, a strong woman, an honorable Calypsian, a valiant warrior. Ponjut, she whispered. The wind blew, stealing the names. Burn them. Without so much as a huff, the dragons angled downward, shooting streams of fire at the dead, until they were each burned to ash. Raven awoke with a start, trying to make sense of the bright blue world above her. I'm flying. She recalled falling asleep astride Ciri, who had continued her path across the desert toward Kesh. Dragons had the remarkable ability to sleep for days on end, and then wake up and remain that way for a week straight. As if reading her mind, Ciri huffed out a hot breath. About time you got up, she seemed to be saying. I'm hungry. Sorry, Raven said, rubbing her eyes. She didn't just feel tired but exhausted, like she'd walked across the desert rather than been carried by the fastest creatures on Earth. The names she'd spoken the night before echoed through her head, silent memories of why she was here. She glanced to either side. Both Shanalin and Ryder continued to slumber, their chins resting against their chests. Oi! She said. Ryder's eyes fluttered open and she stretched. Morning, she mumbled. The dragons have flown all night. They'll be hungry, Shanalin said, yawning. Down, Raven commanded. On command, the dragons angled toward the desert, which stretched in every direction. As they approached the ground, their wings beat the sand into a frenzy, shifting the dune slightly. The moment Raven dismounted, Ciri rolled over and jerked her head toward her belly, demanding a scratch. Raven complied, using her opposite hand to untie a satchel of salted beef from Ciri's underside. She tossed each chunk in the air, and her dragon seared them with a thin stream of fire before snapping her jaws around them. Nearby, Heron's towering form waited patiently as Ryder added a sprinkle of the dragon's favorite spice, mixer, to each piece of bacon. A further distance away, Cronus drank greedily from a bowl of water until it was gone. Then, instead of eating, he slumped down on his forepaws and went right to sleep. Shanalin made his way over. Kesh is close now, he said, glancing at the position of the sun. What will we find there? Ryder asked no one in particular. Information, Raven said. Despite how she'd mourned and honored all 36 Guanero the night before, she knew one of them must have survived. It was the only way a stream could have been sent from Kesh with the news. She was anxious to meet the survivor, to hear the full story behind the attack on the borderlands. Ryder and Shanalin sat in the sand to eat and drink, but Raven couldn't. Her blood felt supercharged with energy. She barely ate anything, the food tasting like dust in her mouth. She did, however, swallow an entire canteen of water. It could be refilled when they reached the desert oasis. She clapped her hands and said, "We must move on." Cronus burst from his haunches at the sound, looking as refreshed as if he'd slept for hours and not just a few minutes. Ciri lowered her head so Raven could climb on. As the desert flowed under them like a white ocean, Raven scanned the area ahead for any signs of life. Before anything else, she saw the smoke. Her heart was exploding in her chest, her blood rushing like raging rivers through her veins. The second Ciri landed, she leapt from her mount, racing toward the grove of palms, most of which had been felled, lying prone on the ground. They were charred and smoking, their leaves burned away. The sweet, delicious fruit they once bore littered the path, cracked, burnt husks. They crunched under Raven's heavy trod as she sprinted into Kesh, coughing as smoke poured into her lungs, her eyes burning. Covering her mouth and nose with the top of her shirt, she dove low to the ground, whirling her head around in shock at the scene before her. Every structure was afire, some already having collapsed. There, the large tent she'd once slept in with her sister, fire, now a desolation of burnt poles and smoking canvas. There, the table she'd dined at with their soldiers, with Goggin, now an inferno, shooting flames into the air, licking at the sunshades she'd once enjoyed so much. There were no people, at least none she could see, neither enemy nor friend. "We have to get you out of here," Ryder said, grabbing her shoulder and pulling her back. The Dragon Master's eyes were wide, her mouth and nose covered with a wet piece of cloth. Raven shrugged her off, twisting away. She darted forward, crawling for the nearest still-standing structure, a small, doorless hut. Flames were dancing from the other tents, tiptoeing onto the hut's roof, climbing down the walls. A scream rent the air. Raven dove inside, scanning the space, squinting through the smoky haze. There! A form lay on the floor, still resting against a toppled-over chair. Smoke was pouring through a window and directly into the person's face. Raven scrambled forward on hands and knees, grabbing the person by the legs, pulling. To her surprise, not only did the form slide across the floor, but the chair too. They were tethered together, locked inside a structure that had become an oven. She hauled with all her strength, her muscles popping, her skin scraping the floor, the smoke sliding lower and lower. She was forced to use two hands, leaving her mouth and nose unprotected, but still she toiled. "I will not let another person die. Not today." She reached the door, and then a second set of hands were there, helping, and a third, Shanalyn, having caught up. Between the three of them, they wrestled the chair across the village and down the path, spilling into the sand. They slumped in a pile, the chair falling onto its side, the occupant releasing a grunt. Raven's lungs and throat burned. Her tongue tasted like ash. Her eyes stung. Her head swam as if filled with salt water. She rolled over, struggling to her knees, fighting to crawl over to the chair which was facing away from her. Spots were dancing before her eyes, the world fading. "No," she thought. "I'll sleep when I'm dead." She rounded the chair, placing a hand on the person's chin, leaving a dark handprint before turning him to face her. For indeed, it was a man. A man she recognized. Guta, the proprietor of Kesh and its famed hospitality. Her friend. He seemed to recognize her, a surprised smile drifting across his lips. And then his eyes slipped closed. 77. The Southern Empire. Citadel. Rhone Lorraine. The dead girl was still staring at him. Her brother, too. Their eyes seemed to core him like an apple, tearing his heart from his chest. Rhone opened his mouth to speak, closed it, opened it again. The words still wouldn't come. "Do I know you?" the girl said, frowning. "Yes, yes, yes, yes." Rhone found the words pouring from his lips before he could stop them. "I'm from Calypso." Her frown deepened for a moment and then suddenly vanished, her lips parting, her eyes widening, her eyebrows lifting. "By the gods," she said. "You can't be here. We can't talk to you." Rhone felt off kilter, like he was attached to an invisible pendulum, swinging, swinging, rocking. "Why not?" "He'll kill us. Your guardian will kill us." As the final word slipped from her lips, the girl turned and raced back up the steps, shepherding her brother before her. Rhone dropped from his mount, stumbled, and then gave chase, but Goggin blocked his path, holding him back with a single huge hand. Rhone stared daggers at him,
I need to find that girl,
he said, hoping words could help where his muscles had failed him.
No time for chasing tail, Goggin said. Gotta find Lady Windy.
I'm not...
Roan's words fell away. There was no way to adequately explain the situation. Plus, it seemed the girl and her brother, dead, they were supposed to be dead, worked for Windy anyway. So finding her might help find them. Goggin turned to face the gatekeeper, who was looking even more unsettled than before.
We're going up those steps, the Guanero commander said. Try to stop us.
Though the man protested, they left their mounts in the small entryway.
They'll sleep all day anyway, Goggin muttered as they ascended the steps.
Roan tried to see past the large man, but he was like a lunar eclipse. Eventually, however, they emerged through an arched doorway. Roan blinked, his breath hitching.
Holy gods!
The domed structure had been spectacular from the outside. Inside, it was simply magnificent. The glass dome shimmered with sunlight, the mid-afternoon rays angling in and splashing light across one end while casting shadows on the other. At the dome's peak, a ladder descended to a white marble platform connected by a staircase to the highest of a dozen ringed walkways that followed the curving walls of the immense structure. At various intervals, a platform sprung from each walkway toward the center of the space, like cogs on a wheel. Each platform was supported by its own marble column, beautifully carved. However, what truly captured Roan's attention was the inner section of the building, which was home to hundreds upon hundreds of circular bookshelves, each rising from the floor and high into the air, ending near the top walkway. The strangest thing, however, was that portions of these bookshelves appeared to be moving, spinning, really. Roan's gaze travelled along one of the spinning shelves to its adjacent column, and then upwards to the nearest platform, which, in this case, was situated on level 6. Atop the platform was a scholar who was reaching beyond the banister to pull a series of handles attached to the shelving. With each pull, that particular section of the shelves rotated, the spines of thousands of books flying past so rapidly it was impossible to read their titles. The scholar was unfazed, spinning faster and faster until, finally, she slammed her heel into one of the handles, stopping the motion. Lightning quick, she reached out and snatched a title from the top shelf, briskly flipped a few pages, and then placed it on a wheeled cart resting nearby. A dozen volumes later, she wheeled the cart away. The whole event took only a few moments to transpire, and left Roan with several questions. What sort of mechanism allowed the massive bookshelves to rotate like that? How many books were contained on each section of shelving? And, most importantly, how had the scholar located the books she desired so quickly? His inner thoughts were extinguished like a candle pinched between two moistened fingers when Goggin said,
"It smells funny in here,"
wrinkling his nose. Roan thought it smelled wonderful. Not dusty or old, like he had expected an ancient archive to smell, but like fresh parchment and ink with the subtle smell of glue. To Roan, it was the aroma of knowledge. For somewhere amongst the thousands of books were answers to the questions that had haunted him his entire life. For a moment, he forgot all about the girl and boy from his past, the ghosts of his darkest nightmares. But then, like a flash of light, they returned to the forefront of his mind, standing beside a wispy woman with sharp, intelligent eyes and a dark head of curly hair that resembled an old bird's nest.
"Prince Roan," she said, "I am Windy Sands, keeper of the Citadelian Archives. Would you like some tea?"
In hindsight, Roan should have said no to the tea. It was thick, more like beef stew than herbs steeped in water, with a taste like mud, or how Roan suspected mud would taste. But in the moment, he'd been so shocked by the question and the reappearance of the girl and boy that he'd been unable to utter anything but, "Yes, please, that would be lovely." Now, as he tried to choke down the thick sludge, he fought off the urge to gag.
"Good,"
Windy said, nodding in his direction.
"Delicious,"
he gasped. They were in a private room.
"My personal study,"
Lady Windy had called it. which seemed to Roan to be more of a place to store junk. When they'd entered, Windy had used her hands to push books and scrolls and sheets of jumbled parchment away to clear a space for them to sit at the square stone table. The rest of the slab was hidden beneath various paraphernalia, including two maps of the Four Kingdoms, several iron talismans tied together with string, a half-dozen dirty teacups stained brown, and, of course, the endless stacks of paper, among other oddities. The area around the table was also filled, and Roan had nearly knocked over three teetering towers of books on the way to his seat. The walls were adorned with paintings, each labelled with the name of the artist and the piece, as well as the year it was created. Most of them were crooked. Compared to the meticulous order of the archives themselves, this room was nothing short of a mess that might have been caused by a tornado passing through. Goggin had given the room one look and said,
"I'll be outside attending to the guanic."
"And drinking Simpra," Roan thought wryly, wishing he had some of the strong drink to wash down the taste of the horrid tea. He smacked his lips several times, trying to generate some saliva, and then said, "Those two you sent to collect me at the entrance, the boy and the girl."
"Yila and Daris," Windy said. "Two of my most prized students. What of them?"
"They're not from Citadel."
"That's not a question," Windy said. "But I'll answer, anyway. No, they're from Calypso. I heard you grew up there."
"Yes, from before I can remember. My guardian raised me for a while, and then not."
"What happened to him?"
Roan remembered the fear in the girl's, Yila's, eyes, when she said Markin Swansea would kill she and her brother if she spoke to Roan. Now that he had accepted they were really, truly alive, pieces of a puzzle were slowly coming together. Clearly, his guardian wasn't the monster he'd pretended to be. He hadn't killed the children, only scared them into leaving Calypso.
"Because they knew my secrets," Roan thought.
"No, they know my secrets." Just as quickly, he wondered what they'd told Windy of his past, if anything. He realized Windy was still awaiting an answer to her question.
"My guardian died," he said. "How?"
The woman asked each question casually, sipping her tea, as if she cared not for the answers. Roan got the distinct impression it was an act, feigned indifference to hide her keen interest.
"I don't know. I'd already left home, seeking my own path."
Roan did know. His guardian was murdered, but didn't feel compelled to share the information with this stranger.
"Mm-hmm."
"When did you come to know Yila and Daris?" Roan asked, trying to push the attention away from him.
"Their family arrived years ago, but I suspect you already know that. Who are they to you? Old friends?"
"More like old ghosts," Roan thought.
"Acquaintances," he said.
Still, he couldn't help but be glad they were alive, that his guardian hadn't murdered them on his account. How many years he'd spent fearing his own powers because of what might happen to those around him if he used them. Wasted time. He chided himself silently. There was no point dwelling on a past he couldn't change.
"My niece was terribly vague about your purpose here," Windy said.
"Scholarship," Roan said.
"Hmm, yes. Vague."
She sucked down the rest of her tea and promptly refilled her cup from the kettle. The thick tea chugged from the spout slowly, almost oozing.
"I'm sorry, but I really must insist on privacy," Roan said.
The last thing he wanted was a Sands learning of his mission. If word got back to the Empress, he suspected his irrevocable past of the Citadelian archives would become less irrevocable.
"You have experience searching our bookshelves?" Windy asked.
There was a hint of smugness behind her words.
"Well, no, but how hard can it be to find a book?"
He remembered the ease of the scholar, how she'd spun the shelves and snatched volumes to stack on her cart.
"Indeed," Windy said. "Well then, I leave you to it."
With that, she stood, taking her tea with her. Before she closed the door, she added,
"I will arrange a private room for your scholarship. Only the best for a prince of the West."
2 days later, Rhone was at his wit's end. He'd begun his search with excitement, starting on the first level and vigorously spinning the bookshelves, scanning the titles for anything referring to the Western Oracle, or one of the various common names for fate marks, namely skin marks, sin marks, and tattooia. After being scolded by other scholars on several occasions, he quickly learned there were certain rules, the most important of which was first come, first served, meaning that whomever arrived on each platform first had rights to browse the shelves for as long as they wished without interruption. Hence the daily rush of people hurrying to enter the archives first. Having to wait in line greatly slowed his progress, especially considering he didn't have the first clue where to start looking. Several times he tried to ask for assistance from other scholars, but they just shook their heads, muttered an apology, and swiftly walked away. Something about their reaction smelled of Windy's influence. Goggin had popped in several times, his breath smelling of Simpra.
"Having fun yet?"
the man had quipped, slapping Roan on the back. His raised voice and raucous laughter drew several annoyed looks from other scholars, but they all wisely kept their opinions to themselves, and Goggin didn't seem to notice. Windy, however, was notably absent, presumably hunkering down in her private room. The second day, Rhone decided to go all the way to the top level. It made sense to him that the most secret of information, the most valuable knowledge, would be housed at the apex of the towering shelves. Goggin had joined him this time, surreptitiously sipping Simpra from a hip flask and amusing himself by reading the titles of each book he spotted. Backwards.
"Freemen Baronian, the of history tragic and brief, A. Sans Sky, Empress of Exoneration, thee."
And on and on. Each time he read a title, he'd crack up laughing.
"Maybe books aren't as bad as I thought," he'd said.
Rhone ignored him, his frustration mounting. Each turn of the bookshelves was beginning to feel like a large step backwards. Eventually, the Guanera commander had left. Twice, Rhone had seen Windy flitting about, her hair still a tangle, wearing the same clothes as the day before. When she noticed him staring at her, a caterpillar smile had appeared on her lips. "The woman is mad," Rhone had thought. Now, however, he was on the verge of swallowing his pride and risk bringing her into his confidence in order to get some help. Else he might be wandering the bookshelves until the war came to Citadel and all was lost. Just as he made up his mind, Yila and her brother appeared, climbing a staircase and on to the top level. Rhone stood, transfixed, unable to look away from either of them as they approached. It was like a window into the past, their forms changing to children and back to the present in an instant. The girl stopped immediately before him. She was still tall and wiry, but now had developed the curves of a woman, a narrow hourglass. Her brother, Darris, had shot up like a weed, his face pocked with acne. She stuck out her hand. "Yila," she said. Rhone stared at her brown fingers, shocked for a moment, but then bent to kiss them lightly, remembering the Calypsian custom when meeting strangers. "Rhone," he said. Darris touched his chest and said,
"Darris."
Rhone nodded at him. "You're not scared of speaking to me anymore?" She shook her head.
"Windy told us your guardian is dead."
"He is.
All those years ago, he threatened you."
"Yes," Yila said.
"Our very lives. I believed him. I'm sorry."
"Don't be." She laughed. Rhone cocked his head to the side, trying to figure out what could possibly be amusing about a death threat.
"He also paid for our silence, and for us to leave Calypso forever. Very richly, in fact. Your guardian wasn't a very good haggler."
Now Rhone laughed, too. It was true. Markin Swansea had been pitiful when it came to negotiating a fair price, always accepting the Calypsian merchant's initial exorbitant offer.
"I thought you were dead, both of you. He showed me your bones in the fire pit."
The girl's laughter fell away.
"For that, I am sorry. It must have been hard on you. We were just children then."
"I hated him for it. I ran away from home."
"Oh, gods," Yila said. "I didn't know. While we were living like royalty, you were living on the streets."
Roan didn't care about any of that. Not right now. His world had been turned upside down in the best possible way. For once, a tragedy had been reversed. For once, peace had ruled the day. "I'm fine now," he said. "Did Lady Windy tell you who I really am?" Yila nodded, her dark eyes suddenly shining. "A prince of the West. Roan Loren." She paused for a moment, as if trying to decide something. Then she said, "Well, Roan Loren, I never properly thanked you for what you did that day, when you healed my broken leg. You bear a tattoo, don't you?" Once, Roan might have lied, would have come up with some plausible explanation and then made a run for it. Not any more. "Yes," he said, "I do. The life mark." The girl nodded, as if he'd only confirmed something she'd known for a long time. "If not for your actions, I might have never walked again. And, to boot, we got paid for it. I am forever in your debt. Whatever you are looking for, I can help you find it." After that, things went much more quickly. Even if Yila decided to tell Windy what he was looking for, Roan was willing to bear the risk. And she'd promised him she wouldn't, a promise he was inclined to believe. So he'd told her. Not everything. He didn't have time for a story that long. But the basics. How he believed the Tattooia, or fate marks, were the key to restoring peace to the Four Kingdoms. How knowledge was crucial, and that his search had led him to Citadel. He didn't mention Bare Black Boots, or the possibility that the Western Oracle or her son might still be alive. He didn't want her to think him mad. Though it was well past sundown, or so Roan suspected, he pored over the stacks of tomes Yila continued to deliver every hour or so, the candlelight dancing across the pages. Goggin had returned once, but soon tired of reading titles backwards, and had left seeking sustenance. Roan didn't expect to see him again until the morning. Late morning, more than likely. Thus far, he'd found 6 references to the fate marks, most of which were first-hand accounts of the powers they gave certain individuals. People who became weapons used by their kingdoms. "They only made things worse," Roan whispered. "What?" Roan hadn't realized Yila stood in the doorway. She looked exhausted from all her running around on his behalf, but she hadn't complained once. Daris had gone to bed hours earlier, but she had persevered. The first people bearing Tattooia, fate marks, were used to exacerbate the war. Their rulers made them into soldiers, and they did battle for years. "I know the stories," Yila said. Of course she did. She was a scholar in training, after all. According to Windy herself, Yila was one of her prized students. "What else do you know?" Roan asked, feeling foolish for not having asked in the first place. "I know nothing has changed. Those with fate marks, as you call them, are still weapons. The Ice Lord in the north, now dead. Bjorn Stonesledge in the east. The Slave Master in Fanes, also dead. Even Lady Windy's niece, Fire, was a bringer of death and violence before she was killed." "Gwendolyn Storm," Roan added in his head. It was true of her as well. Though she tried to use her powers for good, to save lives, she was still thought of as a weapon by the ruling ironclads. He nodded thoughtfully. "The mindset has to change." "To what?" "I don't know. I'm hoping if we can learn more about the Western Oracle and her purpose for creating the fate marks, we can learn how to use them to achieve peace," Yila filled in. "Exactly." Yila nodded, moving into the room, depositing her new stack of books onto the desk. "That's the last of them," she said. The declaration sent a shiver of excitement tinged with fear through him. What if the answer he'd been looking for was sitting right in front of him? What if it wasn't? What then? "And look at this," Yila said, interrupting his thoughts. She cracked open the book on the top of the pile, carefully turning the pages until she reached one she'd marked with a bit of string. Roan slid over as she pointed to the part she wanted to show him. A passage of text, supposedly spoken by the Western Oracle, while being prepared for her fiery execution in Night's End.
for they must put to bed their disputes, their hate, their anger at acts of the past, the traditions of their fathers and forefathers. Only the fate-marked can help them achieve this. Only the fate-marked can unite the four kingdoms before the day of commencement. If they do not, they shall be unprepared for the horde that shall sweep across the land, consuming all.
The words sent a shiver through Roan.
Horde, he said. Have you ever heard of that?
Ela shook her head.
No, never. I started to look for other references, but didn't see anything. It will take a long time to search these books.
Roan chewed his lips, wondering what this horde was in all capital letters. Something about the word resounded inside him, like a hammer striking again and again. It felt important.
Is this why you created us? He thought. Is this the purpose for everything? Will one of the kingdoms go too far, seeking the annihilation of all the others?
Given his experience with rulers like Rhea Loren and Grian Ironclad, it certainly wasn't out of the realm of possibility.
You should go to bed, he said. I'll need to sleep eventually, and then you can take over the search.
Not a chance, she grinned. I want to be here. Roan could see the fires of potential discovery in her eyes. She was a collector of knowledge, not to be denied. He understood the feeling. He waved at an empty chair.
Thank you, he said. I could use your help.
78. The Southern Empire, Citadel. Bare Blackboots. Roan Loren had shown up 2 days earlier, as he knew he would. The young man was determined, that was for certain.
He is the one,
Bare Blackboots thought now, watching as Roan sat at the table with the scholar girl. Though they had a private study to work in, the door remained open. No one was left in the archives except them. And Bear, of course, but he had his ways. He hid behind one of the stacks, peering through a gap in the books, a gap he had created. His perfect vision magnified the open room beyond. When you were as old as he was, you learned a few tricks. Still, Bear knew that Roan could read every word in those books, and he still wouldn't have the answer he craved.
Mother, I am here. I am fighting for the peace you believed in, the peace you died for.
Of course, she didn't answer. He wasn't sure whether the Western Oracle was gone forever or if she was merely sleeping, her soul exhausted from the years of waiting. But that didn't matter, because Bear was here. Bear was the answer, the truth of his mother's wisdom inked on his very skin, hidden beneath his dark cloak. He'd lived many lives, but this one was the only one that truly mattered.
I shall be the truth-bringer, he thought. Mother, I will not fail you.
He retrieved the book from his deep pocket. He'd removed it from the bookshelves days ago, safeguarding it until this very moment when the time felt right. His large fingers brushed the tattered leather cover, tracing the letters etched into it. The Death of Absence, it was titled. A story of woe by the Western Oracle. Despite the years, seeing his mother's title, the one that had condemned her in the end, brought a tear to his eye. He dashed it away before it could fall on the book. He opened the book to the last page, which contained only 2 sentences. 4 words.
Absence lives. Find it.
A shiver ran down Bear's spine. He plucked a quill from the floor, dipping it carefully in a pot of ink. Slowly, he penned a brief message.
Find absence. Find the truth, and find me, Bare Blackboots.
On silent feet he travelled the arc of the top-level corridor until he was immediately outside the room. No sounds arose but breathing and the occasional turning of pages. He propped the book against the wall and left. It was time for another voyage, the first he had taken since his childhood. He'd departed Tarragon a boy. He would return as a man. 79. The Southern Empire, Citadel. Windy Sands.
The large bearded man thought he was a ghost, floating in secret through the archives. But he wasn't, at least not to Windy. The archives were hers, and she knew everything that happened within their bounds. Through a false mirror hanging on the wall, she saw the man write something in the old book, and then leave it outside Roan Loren's study. After the man left, and she assumed he was gone for good, she stole through the large domed space and took the book. Hours later, her eyes burning from lack of sleep, she turned to the last page, saw the message.
Bear Blackboots, she thought.
The name sounded familiar, and yet she couldn't place it. She'd read a lot of books over the years, more than she could count or keep track of. This was a fleeting name, one she'd probably come across in the midst of one scholarship or another.
"Who are you?"
she wondered aloud.
"And what have you to do with the Terran god absence?"
Or with the Western Oracle, for that matter. For she knew it was information on the Oracle and her legendary fate marks that Roan was seeking. The urge to take the book to Roan Loren and demand answers rose inside her, but she tempered such hasty actions. She was a woman of patience, of wisdom. No, first she would see how this played out, before offering the book in exchange for his story. And then, perhaps, they would take a trip south, across the burning sea, together.
80. The Southern Empire, Calypso. Raven Sands. Guta had lived for a few more hours, drifting in and out of consciousness, before eventually succumbing to the smoke inhalation. Raven, more than ever before, wanted to sit down and cry. Instead, alongside Ryder and Channelin, she stared at Kesh as it burned all the day long and into the night. They didn't sleep, they didn't speak. Their dragons seemed to understand the gravity of the situation, remaining equally silent and calm. At dawn, Raven buried Guta in the middle of the destroyed oasis. It was what he would have wanted, she knew. They picked through the still-hot rubble, finding dozens of other bodies. Guta's employees, probably. Travelers, maybe. One of the Guanero, perhaps, whomever had survived the battle on the borderlands, only to die in Kesh. Heavy footprints marred the sand to the north of the desert village, pushing northeast back toward the border. The Eastern Army, Raven knew. It was the furthest they had ever ventured into the Skara, a bold act that had struck a blow that might as well have been the heart of the Empire. Staring at the destruction around her, it felt strange. The last time Raven had been here, it had been a vibrant oasis of joy in the midst of a harsh desert landscape. Now, it was nothing but a burnt tangle of sticks and canvas, palm and brush. Despite the change, she no longer felt sick, her stomach formed of leather and fire. No, she felt only anger, dragon fire in her blood. Ryder shook her head while Channelin said, "This was an act of war." "Yes," Raven agreed. She could deny the Dragon Master no longer. "We must return to Calypso immediately and convene the War Council." "Soon," Raven said. "First, we must stop in Citadel." Channelin frowned. "Why? What is in the City of Wisdom that could possibly help us plan a war?" Raven had not informed her of her Guanero commander's secret mission. "Goggin, for one. And information. Something that could change everything. When we attack Feria, our victory must be total this time. Next to what we are going to do, the Dragon Massacre will be remembered as a minor skirmish." The City of Wisdom shone like a beacon in the midday light, flanked by an ocean so blue it might have been a painting. It had been many years since Raven had travelled to Citadel. The last time was when she was 10 years old, spending the summer with her Aunt Windy, the keeper of the vast archives housed within the bowels of the city. Though Raven wasn't much for books, except for the occasional tome regarding the history of dragon lore, she'd enjoyed her time there, swimming in Dragon Bay and exploring the library while her aunt studied books all the day long. She'd been sad when her mother wouldn't allow her to return the following year. "You will soon be a woman.
"It's time you began preparing for the future," her mother had said. Raven hadn't thought about Citadel much since then, throwing herself into training the Dragonia and learning the art of combat. Now, however, her good memories from summers spent in this city came rushing back. She blinked them away.